Florence and the Machine from 2018. The song's called June. I just spent a few minutes trying to figure out who was singing harmony on that song, and it's Florence. Nobody's credited for harmony on that track, which means it's her. A lot of people playing on that track, and I guess Isabella no longer with the group. I'm curious what she's up to these days. You're listening to Planet Waves FM, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. This is a portion of my program called Tantra Studio, which is a discussion of sex in the context of self-actualization and spiritual growth, which we've been hearing a bit about in the context of this Venus Vesta conjunction in Gemini, coincidentally with all of this very unusual activity by Chiron. As I'm fond of saying at the beginning of the show, Mercury is telling us we've got some things to talk about here beside the rising tide, and the tide of Mercury is most certainly rising. The idea that I have for tonight's Tantra involves learning your own language. With people are kind of a puzzle, I think, and one of the puzzles I have with people is figuring out how to have the conversation with them. Like, how do you keep the conversation meaningful, present, and creative? So sometimes that involves relating to their interests and taking an interest in their interests. And hopefully you have an innate interest in their interests. I mean, I've got one friend who is a gunsmith. Now, I don't think about guns very much, but I'm curious about gunsmithing. And from Boy Scout days, certainly curious about weapons and taking care of them. So we always have something interesting I can talk about, and have an open invitation, I guess, pre-pandemic, to go shooting and experience a diversity of weapons. We have a common ground, and we have certain other common ground. I've got a friend in L.A., Mike, one of my oldest friends from high school, and I've learned how to focus him on discussions of music and have great fun talking to him and, like, learn a lot. Like, there, if I can formulate the right question, like the one I'm going to send him now is, what do you know about the drum track on Heart of Glass? Now, I'll tell you what he says, and I predict it's going to be really exciting because he knows Clem Burke, and he's a drummer, and going to get my questions answered. How many tom-toms are in there? Now, lovers, we have the same thing. There's a, you know, there's a mystery to people, and you have to learn their language. I mean, Adrienne Rich has a beautiful poem called The Dream of a Common Language. It's a whole book, actually, and you will not be disappointed. And it's easy poetry to read because it's beautiful on the surface and it's meaningful on the surface. And then as you keep rereading and you can pick out four lines and keep reading them, you go deeper and deeper and deeper. And one of the things she says, one of my favorite couplets in the poem, couplets is the drive to connect, the dream of a common language. And so we think about this a lot with other people, but there's a level within ourselves that we can bring the common language to a more fluent level, a more natural level. And there are things that we can learn to say to ourselves and learn to ask ourselves and learn to inquire and explain and generally converse about. And this might be in a verbal dialogue that you speak outwardly, perhaps into a mirror. A great time, by the way, for mirror exploration with all of this Gemini, right? The concept of the mirror is implicit in Gemini, because who, you know, what is this? Two humans? First time we get to humans in the entire zodiac, there's two of them. And they're twins of some kind. Maybe they're lovers, brothers, sisters, twins. Over time, the myth has evolved and shifted, and the illustration of the Gemini sign in the lover's card has changed over time. And one of the things I often think about with Gemini is this idea of an ideoglossia. Maybe if you studied linguistics, you've heard this term. Maybe you're just interested and heard it. Ideoglossia is a language that twins develop between themselves before they learn to speak their native language. Twins spend a lot of time together. They've been together since they were in the womb. So they've been formulating and becoming human and learning and growing. And they sometimes, not all twins have this. I would love to hear this. Maybe there's recordings of it. Develop an ideoglossia, which you can think of, my dad explained it, as an idiosyncratic ideoglossia, glossary. So it's their unique glossary that they have. And kids all have baby talk, right? They have their, you know, words for, I remember two of mine. Bagabaga was the bottle. Begebege was cigarettes. Nui was my little white crib blanket that I slept around till I was too big, like three or four. So kids all have baby talk, right? But baby talk is meaningful. And if you're a careful parent, you're interested in the kids' baby talk and you learn their baby talk. Well, you might think of ideoglossia as twins having baby talk wherein they can communicate in whole thoughts. This is fantastic, right? I mean, is this just... this is science fiction territory, right? This is a good idea for a fantasy novel. So now think of the Gemini element of who every individual is, the inner twins, whoever they might be, as also having an ideoglossia. That idiosyncratic glossary, that certain way that you can learn to communicate with yourself. And maybe you don't have this and this is your opportunity to develop it. Maybe you are dimly aware of it and have it. Maybe you can make this a conscious process, all highlighted with all of this Gemini and Mercury going on. Now, everyone has a way of communicating with themselves. If you get to know people closely enough, you find out that some are more gentle than others, and some can be quite vicious. Some very, very nice people, kind and lovely people, can be incredibly vicious with themselves and how they talk to themselves and what they call themselves. And a lot of this is internalized abuse coming from their parents' generations. And I would be highly suspect of any harshness that you dole out to yourself, because there is almost 100% probability that this is internalized abuse, that you are just continuing to act out on yourself. So in spiritual growth and in therapy and in life, hopefully, people learn how to be gentler with themselves. And, you know, if you're one of these people who wants to be a better person and get things done and all that, you might find you get a lot better result being gentle with yourself than being harsh with yourself. So to some extent, we all, greater or lesser, have a way we communicate with ourselves. And there's a lot going on inside of every person, a whole internal universe that you don't really think about on the first date. I mean, you often don't think about it much at all with many people, and even intimate partners can be quite good at concealing their inner reality from one another, concealing their historical reality from one another. And my observation about this astrology of Venus Vesta Gemini and then Mercury making all these squares is that this is first about developing and cultivating your interior idioglossia and learning this, getting words for things, having a way to express things to yourself, taking things out of that mysterious, foggy, half-formed level of awareness and bringing it to a more conscious verbal level. Now, this may have a slight sheen of weirdness. There are some people more comfortable maintaining an inner dialogue with one another. There are some people who are more comfortable revealing things to themselves that are challenging and then that they would also be reluctant to reveal to others. So my sense of this reluctance is that it is a probably fenced off area guarded by the guilt, embarrassment or shame type of boundaries. There are some that I've noticed who seem to have no interest in what's going on inside. And there's a good few people who seem to have no interest and who, you know, it's surprising when they become dimly curious of an internal process within themselves. Now, as an astrologer who works with people on their internal process, one of the things I do is I play Vesta and I hold space and hang out and help people learn language that they can correspond with themselves in, and like kind of help them take notes and say, okay, we've got something, let's give this thing a name, and you know, you can continue to relate to it, you can continue to experience this and develop your own relationship with it. When it comes to sexuality, there is a rather profound lack of ability to communicate with and, in a sense, message oneself honestly. And one of the reasons for this is that that the whole realm of sexuality is so veiled and concealed and blocked as to be unintelligible or even inaccessible. And there can be so much pain contained in that. When you cut into that internal area, that barricaded area, that I think many people must have this experience. I don't know if they get there or cut open, but some do. You don't know what you're going to find there exactly. You may have some concept. You know, you may know that bad things happened. You may know that there are ways your trust was violated. You may have a sense that events and people's intentions, people's treatment of you, whether intentional or inadvertent, alienated you from yourself in a certain way. But it's another thing to open up that territory. And as you do, one of the most important tools that you're going to have is the ability to put things into words, to get them off of the foggy, murky morass of emotions and sensations and bring them into a level where you can document what you're thinking and feeling, where you can relate to the documentation of what you were thinking and feeling in the past, and then, if you feel ready, communicate with another person. Now, even if we're talking about the most, you know, basic level of seemingly ordinary sexual communication, what I think of following a bit of Brad Blanton's lead of telling your whole history, and I think also describing your present reality and what you want. Even that can be under considerable strain of not having the words, not being able to find the words if you might think you have them, and then this embarrassment barrier of putting them into words. Putting your thoughts and history and feelings and desire into words. And that doesn't include saying, you know, I slept with John Smith. It's like, this is the sex that I had with John and sharing about it. This is particularly important when there's disclosure around extra relationship affairs, when there's a healing process involved in the affair, that the details and the feelings be understood by the people involved in the healing process. To do this in any form, including like, this is what I want to do tonight, takes a learning process of being able to match your feelings and thoughts to words, and then getting over the embarrassment, potential embarrassment, or reticence or something, whatever it might be, of sharing it. And a couple of things. One is that this takes practice. Practice, practice, practice. And so it's important to practice with yourself in your journal. I you know, don't recommend publishing this straight away. I think that journal is a more intimate form of self-to-self expression than involving a computer, but you know, you might just find that you're going to type it into your keyboard. I would experiment and see where you feel like you can be the most transparent and the most honest with yourself. And learn your language. Now, to go from written to verbal is a leap. There's another embarrassment barrier. There's either talking to yourself or talking to someone else, the implication of being heard and witnessed. And so if you're in this process of learning your idioglossia and then learning to communicate your idioglossia to another person, which is liberating, and you can start to have your wishes fulfilled, and you might find out who is interested in helping you fulfill your wishes by being able to say what they are. Practice, practice, practice. One. And number two is, one of the first tantra concepts I learned, which is to say, a concept about sexuality that places it in the framework of self-actualization and spiritual growth. Joe taught me this one, is go toward embarrassment and not away from it. Embarrassment is a veil. Most people will shy away from the veil. They will eschew the thing that's invoking the embarrassment because the embarrassment is serving as one of those boundaries or barriers or inner fences or something like this. You may find, if you go toward the thing that's embarrassing to say, which generally means the details about the experience, how you felt about it, both, there is a lot of pleasure. There is erotic power, and there is a a region of yourself that you will discover every time you cross one of these, let's say, embarrassment veils. You will discover territory in yourself. And if you can sustain that territory, that language, if you can sustain that feeling tone and that vibration long enough to communicate it, the experience can expand and you can find yourself going on some very interesting journeys. Now, it's necessary to give yourself permission to do this. It is transgressive. The mere idea of using a fence as a metaphor, which came up intuitively from my unconscious, right? I found the fence inside myself and cut the fence, is to do that itself implies transgressing a boundary. It's exactly what you're doing. The embarrassment scrim is a boundary, and it's generally a boundary that is placed inside of you to keep self-knowledge away from you. So I will tell you that it is my view that there is an intentional conspiracy to block people off from self-knowledge, and the best way to do that is to block them off from sexual self-knowledge, which fuels all kinds of creativity about every other facet of self. Once you're honest with yourself about your sexual curiosity, then, you know, why you want to paint or need to make music or all this is like all easy peasy. It takes a certain kind of discipline, but so does this. And there are a few things about self-knowledge. One of my favorite lines of lyrics comes from a Lou Reed song. I forget which one. It's from the New York album, my moment of direct intersection with Lou Reed. He says, "Self-knowledge is a dangerous thing, the freedom of who you are." And so one of the reasons that we put up these scrim barriers and don't cross them and don't get too curious and didn't get too curious as a child is because our self-knowledge threatens others. What does it threaten? I don't really know except to say that often when someone is self-actualizing in an environment, community, family, circle of friends, really figuring out who they are. That doesn't happen every day. A lot of lip service about it. A lot of jingle jangle. This is my thing. I've discovered that deep down I'm a yoga teacher. No. When someone's actually cutting the fence and finding out what's in there, can send a shockwave through their environment. And the shockwave and or the fear of the shockwave can be enough to not cut the fence. It's like, no, put that clipper back in your pocket and stop doing that. Don't go digging for whatever. So you have to agree with yourself that you're going to do this even if it violates the rules of your family, of your community, of your church, of your marriage, of your whatever. Like, for example, I mean, in a marriage, right, a lot of ways that – one of the ways that monogamy is maintained is people go into denial about their real sexual feelings and desires. This is fairly obvious why they might do this. Were they, the thinking kind of goes, to actually admit to themselves what they want, feel those feelings? They might want that in a real way, and it could shift the balance in the relationship. Includes feelings of love for another person, sexual feelings, solely sexual feelings, or sexual feelings with some form of affection, in any combination. In my thinking, it's all very closely related. If you tap into that, it kind of violates common wisdom. Oh, well, don't go there. Don't admit that to yourself. So we do a lot of that not admitting to ourselves. I once heard a very funny rant at a polyamory conference of someone giving all the reasons why their feelings for another person weren't real feelings. They shouldn't threaten the marriage, the primary relationship. I love them, but I don't really love them. They're really just a friend, and I like having sex with them, but it's not real passionate sex. It's just friendly sex. And this writer, I can see her face reading this, and it was breathtaking to see this read. And Dares in California, and she's a really good writer. Go through this reason why everything's not real. This whole denial trip. That's another way to keep the fence in place. The approach that I've taken, and I kind of didn't have a choice because I'm not the kind of person who can conceal my reality very well or for very long, particularly if someone's in my intimate space, in my sphere, in my home, in my bed, in my face, whatever, is that I chose to share my reality. Something in me said, this is long before any therapy or anything, be real. Share your reality. Don't hide your feelings. So this set me on a path, an irrevocable path. There's no going back. Once you start to tell the truth to yourself and feel the feelings that you feel and want the people that you want to do the things you want to do, and you admit yourself, yeah, I want to eat that person's pussy, no debate. If I get to do it, the next step is, if I get the chance, I'm going to do it, right? So if you, it's just probably in the minds of some, you know, better if you don't ever let on that that's the thing you really want to do, because then one thing leads to another. Personally, I have never, 17 years old, 18 years old, not for long, been able to conceal my reality very well from people. And so I learned, well, it messes with me if I do. I trip over myself. I enter all of this very intense discomfort. I feel like I'm lying to myself. It feels icky. There's guilt involved. And so one of the journeys of my life as a lover, as an artist, as a writer, as a man, as all these things, has been to come closer and closer to my true language of expressing what I want, what I feel, and what I've done. That is one of the bases of my discussion last week, of telling the story of my friend and the sex lesson. And then the sum of the subsequent experiences that we had over the course of that weekend was to demonstrate what that's like. To, first of all, model it and show that it can be done, that there's it's possible to do this, and to convey the feeling tone directly, because there's a lot of feeling tone involved. And there's that space that you can get into where the feeling, the words, the desire, and the experience are essentially all the same thing. Now, I understand there's a lot of possible fears here, fears of offending people, fear of making people jealous, fear of being left. You know, some people, this seem to be completely out of the question because their whole livelihood is dependent on another person's perception of their sexual loyalty. And if they violate that, then they might find themselves, with their home and relationship and possibly their children taken away. And if you're in that situation, you have to take a somewhat different approach, I think, and start with the revelation to yourself. Even that can and almost invariably sends vibrations through the relationship. But the thing is that, you know, sooner or later, everything comes out, right? And there's only so much control we have over when it comes out. One day when I was living in Brussels, I had a friend I corresponded with in Israel. I get into these intimate correspondences with people often in other countries. And I forget her name. I really liked her. And she was just like, we had a great conversation going for quite a while. And one day I opened my inbox and there were like 14 pictures of her having sex with someone. All kinds of sex. And masturbating. And fucking him. And everything. And it was open copied to about 100 people. Schoolmaster, relatives, basically her entire address book. Apparently, husband found these photos and pushed the button that I don't know where this button is in my email program, pushed the button and sent it open copied to everyone. I did not assume I knew what happened. I wrote back to her and I said, "Hi, lovely pictures." She said, "Yeah, my husband sent those out." Can you imagine? So there's a lesson in there, which is that there are no private thoughts. And the game we play of private thoughts is a dangerous game, and it blocks us off from all kinds of access to inner resources, inner power. And somebody can just push forward, and suddenly the schoolmaster has got a picture of you masturbating in front of your lover. So there is a good basis for the policy of not keeping sexual secrets. And most of us change partners often enough that it's possible to set a new policy at the time of a relationship change, that you enter the relationship contractually and say, "This is me sexually. I have had an affair or affairs in the past. Actually, I do have multiple attractions to people, even if I'm really bonded with someone or whatever. I've had relationships with same sex or whatever." But the contract is at the beginning, you're going to get me in my sexual truth. I'm not going to get anything else. If you like it, cool. We can have a lot of fun. If you don't like it, hey, plenty of people perfectly happy to have the other way to doing things. It's a dime a dozen shit, right? Let's us all conceal our sexual realities. No. And I think that as part of this like quickening and we're in this transparency thing and lots coming out and there's a lot of evolution, we're being confronted with mortality and the whole world is in reset right now and we're getting to rethink a lot of things. I would propose that we're also in a moment of rethinking how we have our sexual contracts and setting a standard of honesty and transparency. This takes spiritual work. I referenced an article. I mentioned it. I don't know. I talk about it fairly often. It's called Jealousy in the Abyss. Jealousy is a very crucial thing to understand and confront, engage with within yourself, and understand its power over you and power in relationships. Many things are done in the name of, oh my God, this person would be jealous. At that point, you know that jealousy has not been taken as a teacher. Jealousy in the Abyss by William Pennell Rock, the former Swami Anand Virjwar, who does not respond to that anymore. He responds to Pennell Rock. That's how he likes to be known. I met him once. I had my personal darshan in his backyard and had lunch with him. He's somewhere in Northern California. Now he lives in a teepee. The guy's like, got to be 85. I think he's born in maybe 81, 82. Lives in a friggin' teepee in his backyard. And there's a video. You can probably find it. He sends out a letter every now and then, and I get it. And anyway, he breaks down jealousy. He talks about the relationship between jealousy and death and the way in which jealousy, unless we take it as a teacher and learn from it, in a similar way that I'm talking about taking embarrassment, guilt, and shame as teachers and invitations, he's saying take jealousy as a teacher and as an invitation and work with this thing, learn this thing. Very important tool to have. You can, in a sense, you can't do any of this. You can't be sexually honest until you have had a reckoning with jealousy and not transcended jealousy. You'll never hear me say that in a workshop, in a class, in a radio program, in an article, ever. You work with jealousy and you let it guide you as your teacher. You take it as your teacher. It's a form of taking death as your teacher, but it's in a much more pleasant context. And you learn what this has to say about you, and you learn about your insecurities, and you learn about your envy and your jealousy and your guilt and your lack of self-esteem. And you, in the framework of addressing jealousy, one by one, you address these things. You engage them, and you open up one fenced-in area after the next. And you actually live your truth. Now, I recognize that you might say this is easier said than done. Right now, I'm saying it. I first encountered jealousy and the abyss in the summer of 1992. I had two lovers, Sabine, who I mentioned in my San Francisco scene, and Michelle, a bit older woman, and I had learned a lot that summer. It was incredible. Because the women became lovers and fell in love. I had an amazing girlfriend. And then this woman walks into our life. Elegant, beautiful woman named Michelle. And the women bond in a way that's like completely beyond my capacity, in some ways beyond my understanding. And I had to take jealousy as a teacher. And once you've taken jealousy as a teacher, you can then ease that and learn compersion, right? I don't have time to go into compersion, but compersion too deeply right now, but I'll, in the time that I have. Compersion is fully embracing the pleasure and the love of another person and really feeling good about it. It's erotic empathy in both senses of erotic, sexual and loving, in the place where they start to multiply each other. And so once you've begun this dance with jealousy and you've begun to have this conscious relationship with it, and it's no longer so cryptic, and you can be more open about it, and you feel the benefits and the power of being more open about it, then compersion can enter the picture. That's a second step along the way. And whether you're adventurous or not, or have multiple partners or not, getting a handle on a relationship with jealousy and being able to experience erotic empathy deeply facilitate intimacy. They even if you're in a perfect monogamous relationship, they remove many of the barriers to deepening your intimacy with your partner. And if that's what you want, and I mean, I recognize this can be frightening. You meet yourself, you confront yourself, you encounter yourself and in ways that can make you want to run. But if you're courageous and you want closeness to other people, that's a function of honesty and of honesty with yourself and of having the words, learning the words, learning your idioglossia. I've removed the discussion that was at the end of the original version of last week's show, when I added Tantra Studio and then did another one that I released publicly. If you're looking for the first one, I'm going to put a link next to the show called The Book of Blue Compilation. It's a sampler from Book of Blue and my audio art. And the very last one on the bottom, I'm going to keep it on the bottom, is the full program from last week, in case you're wondering, you missed it, you're wondering this thing that I talked about. And there it is to find, and I plan to leave it there for specifically listeners of Tantra Studio. Let's go out with two more from Florence. This is No Choir into a piece called 100 Years. Thanks for listening.
And it's hard to write about being happy, 'cause the older I get, I find that happiness is an extremely uneventful subject. And there would be no grand choirs to sing, no chorus could come in about two people sitting doing nothing. But I must confess, I did it all for myself. I gathered you here to hide from some vast, unnameable fear. But the loneliness never left me. I always took it with me, but I can't put it down in the pleasure of your company. And there will be no grand choirs to sing, no chorus will come in, no ballad will be written, it will be entirely forgotten. And if tomorrow it's all over, at least we had it for a moment. Oh darling, things seem so unstable, but for a moment with your hate, and we will shine a light, and the days will become endless and never turn to night, and never turn to night. And it's just too much, I cannot get you close enough. 100 arms, 100 years, you can always find me here. And Lord, don't let me break this. Let me hold it light. We have no need to fight. We raise our voices and let our hearts take flight. Get higher than those planes can fly. Where the stars do not take sight. I can't describe my bends and breaks so many, many times. And it's born again with each sun.